This VPR News podcast is made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Please make a contribution at vpr.net. Thanks.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Steve Zind in for Jane Lindholm today. Helen and Scott Nearing called it the good life, a life of homesteading that combined rural living, self-sufficiency, building community, and quiet reflection. And the life the Nearings led in Vermont in the 1940s and 50s was an inspiration a generation later for the back-to-the-landers who came here to follow the Nearings' homesteading example. Greg Jolly was one of those people. He was a history and English major at Boston University when he picked up a copy of Living the Good Life.
I found the Nearings book in a used bookstore on Newbury Street, and I brought it back, read it overnight, and within a month gave back my scholarship and dug up the backyard of my parents.
Jolly homesteads in Jamaica, Vermont, not far from where the Nearings lived. But many who tried gave up homesteading. They found it too difficult, too much a life of sacrifice. Still, the Nearings' example inspires people. Today on the program, we're going to talk about why that is and whether homesteading is being redefined. And we'd like to hear from you. Here are a couple of questions to ponder. How do you define homesteading? Do you see it as a way of getting by with the bare necessities, or is there more to it than that? Were you inspired by the example of the Nearings and others, or do you consider them misguided? Are you trying to apply some of the basic principles of homesteading in your daily life? And if so, tell us how. Our number is 1-800-639-2211, 1-800-639-2211, or you can email us at vermontedition@vpr.net. With me today is Rebecca Neal Gould, who's Associate Professor of Religion at Middlebury College and author of the book At Home in Nature, Modern Homesteading and Spiritual Practice in America, and Philip Ackerman Liest, who is the Associate Professor of Environmental Studies at Green Mountain College. Philip Ackerman Liest.
Either way works. That.
Philip and Rebecca, thank you both for being here today.
Thanks for having us, Steve.
Now, Philip, I understand with your class that you teach on homesteading, you start with a very simple exercise by asking the students to define homesteading. And
right.
So what do you see? How much variation is there? How many misconceptions do you see expressed in those definitions?
You see quite a bit of variation. At first, I think there's the question of what homesteading is, and that's what they'd have to struggle through at the very beginning. But a lot of the students are coming from the suburbs. Some are coming from the city. Several are coming from other countries. And so there's this open-ended question about, you know, really what it's all about. And part of my job is to nurture the definition through the course of the course, if you will, but at the same time to keep it open-ended so that everyone feels like they have a conduit into it.
So before they've kind of gathered the information that you present in your course, do you find that there are a lot of misconceptions about homesteading?
You know, misconceptions, I tend to think that a lot of times they think that it needs to be rural, that it needs to be the back-to-the-land approach, that it's all about self-reliance. And those are all things that I try to tackle through the context of the course to start to open up those discussions, because I think if homesteading's ever going to be relevant, then it really needs to recognize we're in an urbanized world, a wired world. It's a much different world from the time of the Nearing, certainly of Thoreau. So trying to find ways to keep it relevant and applicable.
Well, not to get too hung up on definitions, but it would be interesting to find out from both of you what good working definition of homesteading might be. Rebecca?
Well, I was just going to say, in my book, I work some of this out in a typical academic way of starting to give a definition and then unpacking it to be actually all kinds of possible definitions on a continuum. And I do that for a number of reasons. For one, I do think the scholarly obsession with the two-sentence definition, no matter what the subject, often belies the real complexity and subtlety of the subject. But also, and I see this in some of the comments that Philip had me read of his students, and I really loved their comments. I was very impressed with them, that they went to different homesteads and they saw different things. And so what they focused on, I guess these are at the end of the class, mm-hmm. the ones that I wrote, whatever misconceptions they may have had at the beginning, what they focused on later had more to do with sort of values, intentions, qualities of the heart and the mind. Why would you do such a thing and what do you get out of it? That being said, in my book anyway, I clarified that what I was looking for was at least 50% growing your own food, and then went on to give an example of somebody who's a well-known homesteader who doesn't do that at all, and that's Bill Copperthwaite, who sometimes comes to Vermont and gives workshops.
But what makes him a homesteader, then?
Well, what makes him a homesteader is in every other way he is based on the land, and again, I don't think it has to be rural, but he has created everything there from really his own skills. He gets his food sometimes by acquiring it through local beasts that are on his property and visitors who bring it, and his own, you know, kind of little bit of gathering wild foods and so on. And then he's happy to travel and, you know, eat where the rest of us might. And when I asked him why he didn't grow his own food, he said, well, he didn't have a spouse to grow it. And that became a whole nother conversation about gender, which we might get to. But I did want some definition that would sort of hold the ground, and really that had to do with production outliving consumption, the way people led their lives.
And Philip, I think you've said that homesteading is not so much about the how-to as it is about the why. Maybe you can explain that.
Mm-hmm. I think the why is really important, because that keeps you going on the days when it's particularly tough. So ultimately, I really appreciate Rebecca's book, because I think it lays out the fact that the underpinnings of this is really related to values, and that's what drives this whole piece. So, and the way I've tried to deal with it from a definitional point of view is think about it in terms of a combination, sort of a triangle, if you will, of value, skills, and technology. So really thinking about sustainability values, thinking about practical living skills, and thinking about appropriate technologies, and trying to have students see that you can balance that sort of unwieldy triangle in some different mm-hmm. kinds of ways, and it ends up having all these different iterations that we see.
Rebecca, in your book, you give you quote Scott Nearing. Here's his definition of a homestead from 1972. Quote, a habitation in which a family group manages to eke out a living on its own. I mean, that sounds, I think, to many people, pretty severe.
Yeah, well, it's very Scott. And I think people who knew Scott or people who come to know him from his writing see partially justifiable strictness and a sense of overcoming adversity that Scott's well known for, and having a very rigorous, some would say Spartan, approach to homesteading. I do think there is a softer side of Scott that people who I know who knew him closely have seen. But the overall tone of that kind of definition is, you know, we can do it against all odds, and I think that was very much in their style.
You spoke at the Vermont Folklife Center this past summer. There was a series of talks to go along with an exhibit about the Nearings and homesteading at the Folklife Center in Middlebury, and you told me that you were surprised at the turnout. Why do you think? And these are people who aren't doing anything near what the Nearings did. So why do you think there's still that interest in what they did?
You know, I think it's a great question. I have to say that when I sort of took the stage for this talk, I just couldn't believe that people were spilling out into, you know, the other room. And I'd love to think that's because they all loved my book. But I think it's much more an expression of a kind of cultural hunger for doing things yourself, and again, for being more productive than you are consumptive. And as I started talking to people after the talk, you know, everyone had their sort of brood of chickens or, you know, something going on in their backyard that I see as being more and more popular. In fact, I wish I could remember her name, but somebody wrote a wonderful New Yorker article several months ago about this trend of getting chickens. I, of course, think sheep are superior than chickens, but I might get some chickens. But I think what it expresses is a hunger, and it's not just because I'm a religion professor that I would say it's a spiritual hunger on top of everything else. It's, I think, a very much a desire to be connected to nature in some way and to do things yourself. I don't believe self-sufficiency as such has ever been attainable mm-hmm. by any homesteader, and we might get to that. But I do think this desire to produce yourself is a real counter to our consumer culture and the kind of anomie that can come with it.
Do you see that in your students, Philip, or, you know, are they taking the class for out of just curiosity or for other reasons?
Yeah, it's been interesting. It's a class that's grown to the point this year I'm actually teaching two classes each semester, and one this past fall was the honors class. You know, students are yearning for it, and I really think that a lot of it is the they're seeing the ramifications of not asking the questions and living the answers. And that's really what they want to do. They don't always want to ask the questions right away, but they want to live the answers. And I think what they're seeing is the issues of climate change. There's a loss of biodiversity. There's the fragmented landscape, the over-consumption of natural resources, overpopulation, the obesity epidemic, all these pieces that are coming together. And I think homesteading's a response to that. You know, it's I don't want to say it's an individualistic response. In a lot of cases, I think it's a family response, you know, a household response.
Mm-hmm. Let's bring Paul from White River Junction into the conversation. Hi, Paul. Welcome.
Hi. Just briefly, I came up to Vermont in 1968. I experienced the farm and wilderness camps, and they were oriented toward wilderness living and farming. But what I'd like to say is that I tried my best to do some of the things that Scott Nearing taught. I didn't succeed very well. I did to some extent. But at this day and age, I would say let's go a little further than the term homesteading. I think what we really not need to do, and I don't want to be a Luddite, but I think we have to re-agriculturalize America. We have to have government policies that promote agricultural education in schools from the earliest levels. And we have to have the government, and the state of Vermont can be a cutting-edge state in this area, a state that will promote incentives to people for people to go back on the land, to form communities on the land, to live on the land. The softer side of Scott Nearing can be part of this, but we need to go back and make this an important part of our society.
Paul, let me ask you, if you don't mind telling us, why didn't it work out for you when you
took a stab at it?
Well,
it did, but I was a little bit too middle class. I did a lot of gardening. I raised chickens. I raised sheep. We raised goats, and but I had a pottery business, you know, and so I was receiving outside income from my pottery business. We lived very simply. We didn't have electricity. The first 2 years, we actually hauled water from a brook, and we heated by propane. So, you know, we tried, but I think we could have done a lot better, and I think as a society now, we can really think about how to organize this and really do this well.
Thanks, Paul. Appreciate the call. Rebecca?
I'd love to respond to Paul. First, I want to make him feel better. It sounds to me like you really did succeed. First of all, we were just talking about what a range of definitions there are for homesteading. And, you know, you might not call someone who grows, you know, a couple of leaves of lettuce on their back porch a homesteader. But within sort of the general approach that you're taking, I think you very much would fit. And the Nearings like to often say, either directly or indirectly, it's my way or the highway. There's only sort of one way to do it, and you have to be completely pure. And there's kind of a small cottage industry of wanting to sort of poke holes at the Nearing's work and show where they were inconsistent and the fact that they ate ice cream. And among other things, they did have outside sources of income, and I'm not going to get into details of that now, but that's been more and more shown to be the case, both by Greg Jolly, who's done some excellent research, and also a woman named Jean Hay Bright, who lived next door to the Nearings and wrote a book titled Meanwhile, Next Door to the Nearings. And they've both done a lot of very fair-minded research that, you know, they're not out to sort of burn down the Nearing temple, but they do want to show that it wasn't as easy for the Nearings to do this in a self-sufficient way as one might think. And in fact, the Nearings wanted to portray something more self-sufficient than was actually the case for them.
Rebecca Neal Gould of Middlebury College and Philip Ackerman Leist of Green Mountain College are guests today on Vermont Edition as we talk about modern homesteading and welcome your calls and emails. You can email us at vermontedition@vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2211. Here from Grand Isle is Tony. Hi, Tony.
Hi. I came here in 1979 from Massachusetts and then originally from New York, upstate New York, and came with the naive idea of being totally self-sufficient, and that's the term that was being bandied around at that time. What happened was that I ended up teaching school little by little, became a full-time job, and I ended up with a 40-year teaching career. But as I'm retired at this point, what I realized was happening is that I had set up myself after building a passive solar home, learning how to garden, and heating with wood, I set up myself as being what I would call a hybrid. It's kind of akin to the cars, where people thought, you know, you either have to go electric completely or nothing and no gas. And, you know, I'm kind of like half and half. So I felt like it was a fortuitous thing that I did, and I'm kind of glad I did it with no oil heat, and my bills are very low.
All right, Tony, thanks a lot. Would Scott Nearing frown on that, or would he look with approval on what Tony described, Rebecca?
Well, it's interesting. One thing that people forget is one of the main reasons why Scott started to homestead was so he could be a professor in another context. He was blacklisted for his anti-war stance and his anti-child labor stance and for writing, interestingly enough, against World War I and its connection with oil. And that's partly why some of that work has been republished. And so he really used his homestead as a platform for teaching and invited people up there. So I think in terms of Tony's interest in teaching and sort of developing that, that Scott would be very approving. You know, when you actually got down, obviously I wasn't able to interview Scott, but when I interviewed Helen Nearing the number of times that I did, they were very honest once you got them in person. I think the books reflect what I've called in my book a kind of evangelism, a sort of evangelical component to what they were trying to do. And sometimes they said, well, anyone can do this, and then set these incredibly impossible standards. So sometimes they wanted to show how perfect they were, and at the same time they wanted to invite people in. And when people in the late 60s and 70s came out to visit them, if they seemed like they just wanted to talk, then Scott especially would sort of brush them aside. You had to be willing to philosophize and do the hard work. So I think he would respect what Tony has done, even if he might agree with the hybrid term.
Philip, all of the callers and many of our comments have had to do with homesteading taking place in a rural context. I mean, is that kind of a bottom line? Has to be in a rural setting?
I hope not. I mean, I think I'm definitely of the back to the land persuasion. I mean, I share a lot of the background as the callers here do. You know, and reading the Nearings and John Seymour and Gene Logsdon, a lot of other folks, and really being akin to that. But I think you can really translate these things into suburban and urban environments. And in fact, you know, now after teaching this course, A Homesteader's Ecology, with my students for about 7 years, I think that's the more important thing to do in some ways.
Well, try to, if you can, if you don't know of a real example, then give me a hypothetical example of a homesteading taking place in a suburban or urban environment.
Sure. I'll start with the suburban. I had one student, Morgan, who a couple of years ago, he was taking the course, and he started thinking about his yard. And so he coined this term, back to the yard movement, in contrast to the back to the land movement. And so he made these plans, first to convert his backyard into entire food production. Then he moved to the front yard, and then he ended up going to the Rhode Island School of Design to pursue this and to try to figure out ways that you can transform that suburban environment into something that's productive and meaningful again. With the urban piece, I think the favorite example I like to show students is Will Allen from Growing Power, you know, who does just an amazing job in inner city areas, where he's utilizing greenhouses and a lot of other resources in order to crank out an amazing amount of food, and not just plants, but also fish, and compost is a huge piece. And so what he's doing is really transforming entire communities.
So the focus there is on well, kind of one element of what we would consider to be homesteading, and that's producing food. It's not so much on building your own house or living off the grid or anything like that.
Well, I think there's a great book out that Chelsea Green has put out, and it's called The Carbon Free Home by Stephen and Rebecca Wren. And they're down in North Carolina and the Raleigh-Durham area. And they've tried to transform their home within the confines of Raleigh, North Carolina, tried to transform that from the energy perspective, the food perspective. They tried to tackle it to get to zero carbon and done an amazing job. And they tell a very honest tale, which is part of what I really appreciate.
But, I mean, the reality is that in this country, we have a largely urban population, and many of the things that people have described in this program are impossible in that setting. So the question is, Rebecca, what do people in that setting, or can they draw from some of the stories we've heard?
Well, one thing is they have a great baseline, and if you really think about it, my students don't always want to think about it this way. Even I sometimes don't, but you know, New York City is said to be one of the most environmentally responsible places to live in our country because there's so much public transportation. People don't have cars. People walk everywhere. I've seen a lot of stats that show how, you know, contrary to our assumptions, what a green place Manhattan could be. And then you also see in Manhattan a lot of new movements, somewhat like you were talking about, Philip, of growing one's own food on the tops of buildings and things like that. But if you bracket growing your own food, as you were saying, and sort of saying, well, what else can you do beyond that? I think that's where it gets back to this issue of intention that Philip's students were talking about and that I think both Philip and I are very interested in. And, you know, I can't help but go back to Thoreau, who, you know, is a homesteader in a way and not in other ways. It was only a 2-year experiment. But the main thing about Thoreau doesn't have to do with his self-sufficiency that everybody wants to poke holes in, just like with the Nearings, but it has to do with his drive. He wants to drive life into a corner and suck the marrow out of life and not find that when he's died, he hasn't lived. And I think if everyone is asking those kinds of questions, then they're sort of, again, not becoming homesteaders necessarily at all, but they're learning from the kinds of questions that homesteaders ask. And I would add one thing, and that's the language of carbon neutrality and the language of locavore and all these things. When I was doing my research, those phrases weren't out there in the sort of popular press or off of, you know, people weren't talking about those things. And yet those were the things they were doing. And so that might have emerged out of other reasons, but now the things that they're doing are locavore and are carbon, if not neutral, lower. And I think there's very much an interest in cities to figure out what behaviors can you do that will go that route.
Homesteading conjures images of bare bones living and the satisfaction of living self-sufficiently. But it can be defined in other ways, too. As one of our guests says, homesteading is not so much about how, but about why. Today, we're talking about whether there are examples we can take from homesteading. How do you define it? Have you been inspired by some of the writings of the past, like Living the Good Life by the Nearings? Our guests are Rebecca Neal Gould, Associate Professor of Religion at Middlebury College, and Philip Ackerman Leist, who's Associate Professor of Environmental Studies at Green Mountain College. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211, and our email, vermontedition@vpr.net. Here's an email from Marky Reed, who says with her husband, Tim King, she's been developing their homestead for more than a decade now. She writes, quote, "We are both professionals but love working with our land, growing vegetables and fruits, raising animals and eating from what we produce nearly every day of the year." Her question is, what are some of the new twists on the back to the land movement that your guests are seeing this time around? And perhaps I'm reading too much into Marky's email, but I wonder whether technology has influenced how people go about this. Philip?
Well, the thing that comes to mind immediately is at our off-grid home, the question of whether to have satellite internet and whether that's something that contributes to homesteading or, you know, actually denigrates the whole experience. And some days I say that the email actually denigrates, but yeah, I think as a resource, it's been pretty interesting because all of a sudden, for example, Erin, my wife, you know, as she's homeschooling, you know, it's a phenomenal resource for being able to connect with other folks, have discussions about curricula that they want to use for their children. You know, as we have livestock, we have American Milking Devon cattle. Marketing those cattle on the internet was amazing. I mean, having responses from as far away as Washington State.
I also think of things like wind technology, photovoltaic technology, which are things the Nearings, well, maybe wind, but not certainly solar electricity, weren't things that the Nearings had access to. But it's permissible.
Oh, certainly. Actually, it reminds me of a very interesting discussion that was had by the Good Life Center, which is the nonprofit that now holds the Nearings property in Maine. And the older folks, shall I say, were against using computers at all. And the younger folks pointed out that this is the way people communicate now, particularly people who are, say, 30 or under, that's where they go to look for information. And so ultimately we decided to have a website, which some people weren't very comfortable with. And one of the best arguments was, well, look, Scott did everything he could to get his words out. He self-published, he mailed things, he used that place as the center for his words getting out to the public. And so would we be surprised if he used this new technology? then there's the issue of use and abuse. So, you know, I think most homesteaders would say if the technology is taking them away from other direct experiences that are part of what they were looking for, then you have to rethink.
I want to point out, too, that Mark E. Reed, whose email we read part of, also put in a plug for a winter conference that NOFA is holding in which there's a homesteading component, and we'll post that information at our website. Let's go back to the phones and talk with Joe, who's in Bridport. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I got some insight into the Nearing's life there in Maine in the 70s, which few people got. Actually, my brother and I were homesteading at the time. We turned into such curiosities that we were really having trouble finding time enough to homestead because we were getting such a stream of visitors and reporters interviewing us for the papers and all sort of thing. But anyway, looking to move our operation, I went up the Maine coast and stopped at Elliot Coleman's place, which was just, well, I guess it was sort of adjacent to the Nearing's place, and met this guy who turned into a friend, Stan Joseph. He's now dead, but anyway, he was helping Elliot living, you talk about bare bones, he was living out of this little tiny camper trailer, mostly outdoors. But anyway, he would spend 4 hours in the morning, I don't know how many mornings a week or whatever, but it was frequent, going over and helping the Nearings keep their garden going. And he ended up with their farm. I assume it was they willed the farm to him in exchange for all his help. But Scott was in his 90s at the time, and he just wasn't able to keep up the burden. Of course, he had visitors and whatever, but he also had money in pocket. I mean, he had a late model Peugeot sitting in the garage. That wasn't a cheap item. And he had a pretty good income from books and whatever. But
well, Joe, are you still doing anything along the lines of what you did when you were homesteading?
No, I'm kind of a tree farmer right now. I'm trying to get a community going, which will be reasonably self-sufficient and be tapped into the other homesteads, I mean, the other communities around. I mean, they're springing up little by little.
Joe, let me just jump in because you bring up an interesting point that I want to get Rebecca and Philip's response to, and that is, you know, the Nearings were not your typical hardscrabble Vermont farmers. They came to Vermont with enough money to buy a chunk of land. Pay as you go was their motto, but you have to have the money to pay as you go. So is homesteading sort of, in a way, something that you have to have a certain level of affluence to engage in, Rebecca?
Well, I think it's a lot tougher now than it was in the 30s when Helen Scott went to Vermont. They did have some money in their pocket that came from various friends and family, and I think it's important that people know that so they don't feel badly as some of these callers have about not being perfect. So they definitely came with money, and things were cheap. I know quite a few young people who have tried to follow the Nearing model or any model of homesteading, and they just can't afford to buy land. So I do think it's different now. And I think that gets back to some of the things that Philip and his students wisely were talking about that fit my definitional issues, too. And that is you have to look at a continuum and see, well, what is it that you really value and how are you making those values come true? And not to be too obsessed with purism because it's not going to happen. I think cooperative living, actually, some of the co-ops around this area are another way to take on homesteading.
Philip, you know, we've heard from people who have or are trying homesteading, and you're a person who has and is, correct?
Right.
Can you give us a little description of your situation?
Sure. Again, with the economic piece, I mean, we were strapped when we got to Vermont. We did in our marriage vows, actually, say something about homesteading and ask family for a little bit of help. So there was a little bit of a nest egg there to start, but we found a place for $39,000 with a cabin that was sitting on the ground rotting and no electricity, and lived with no electricity or running water for 8 years, and we were able to pay off the land within 3 years. And so I do think there there are ways to do that, and we've gradually now, our friends tease us, we have a large house that we built, which is still off-grid on the same property, but we've also tried to create that so that we have a foundation and a roof, which are the two most expensive parts of a house, that can have two cottage industries there within the house at this point. So, again, we are off-grid, and I think there's some really interesting ways you can make this work. Our students this semester just visited a woman, Barbara, who bought an Amish garden shed for less than $5,000, put it on her place, insulated it, and she's got an amazing homestead now. It's just phenomenal. It was wonderful for the students to actually see this place. So I think you can still make it work.
Here's an email from Paul in Bridport. I've been living off the grid in Bridport for 27 years. It was Rebecca who first called my place a homestead. So I've been trying to derive the meaning of that term from its example now that it's been pointed out to me. The life here is rich and inconvenient. I think my desire was to live a life in touch with a broader reality in life than a job encouraged. Maybe this borders on something that you write about in your book, Rebecca, and that's that intersection between religion and I think I'm using religion in the broader sense, the religious, mm-hmm. and homesteading. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, I think it was a really sort of risky book to write as someone who was a religion professor, and I would say also just to make sure that my environmental studies colleagues get included, that I have another foot in the environmental studies program, so I'm 50% each. But I did worry about trying to make this case that homesteading was something that is not itself a religion, but should be included in the religious story of America. And I think one way that argument works very well is that there's a very long tradition in American literature, culture, and religious life of looking to nature as the source of meaning and authority. And I found that with most of the homesteaders I interviewed, to the extent that I have a mini homestead going on, which wouldn't fit the Nearing's definitions at all. I also feel that this connection with nature is a big part of how I live. It sounds like that's the case for Philip and his family. So I don't remember the exact words that Paul gave you, but I think about vitality and so on, mm-hmm. that there's a way to live, which again gets back to this long tradition following Thoreau of how do you shift your life so that you can live it in the most kind of lively intensity and up to the values that you want to live it by.
Lee in Westminster wants to join the conversation. Hi, Lee.
Hi. Thank you for actually saying all the things I was going to say about it being a religious experience. I have done many things in my life. They were an inspiration to me, and they were like a religion. They just basically set the tone, although my favorite line, not my favorite line, but the line of their books that really laid it out for me is when they said, oh, for those that don't have money, it might be a little different than what we're doing. So, but they did set my chickens free, basically, my soul free, saying that I did not have to be part of the corporate grind. And I took it all over the place. I went into music for a while and played rock and roll and went to Europe and recorded for Polydor, came back from there, started a farm out on Long Island in Wading River with goats and chickens and geese. And now I'm an editorial cartoonist and living in Vermont on a beautiful piece of land, and the agriculture is just part of it. It's really a matter of setting your mind free and doing what you want and following your heart. And that's what they did, and that's what I do. And I started, they planted the seed, and I've taken it from there all over the world.
Thanks, Lee. Appreciate the call. Let's move to Anne, who's waiting in Moores, New York. Hi, Anne.
Oh, hi. We did a little bit differently than most of the young people you've spoken to. We were in our mid-40s, and my husband was working in New York City and really hating the city life. He always loved the woods. We had a little piece of land up here in upstate New York, just across from Burlington. And one day he just said to me, I'm quitting my job, and let's move up there. And I had a few sleepless nights. We gave up pension, insurance, hospital, everything, and moved up here in our mid-40s. And we lived off the grid, no road in, no telephone. We had chickens and a pig and goats and not goats. We only had one goat and ducks and things. And we did really well. I loved it. Being a city girl, I had never done anything. I'd camped, but I'd never done anything like this on long term. But getting back to the spiritual side of it, having lived and worked in New York City for so many years and just thinking, is this all there is to life? And living for the 2 weeks that we came up in the country and absorbed the beauty and just the knowledge that you can grow something and put a little seed in the ground and see it grow was just part, such a big part of our life. We're still here after 30 years.
What's your secret, Anne, after we heard from a number of people who couldn't make a go of it? What would you say the secret to success is?
Well, I have to say, I have to be very honest. I think the secret to success is having some outside income. My husband started teaching, and I worked part-time in a library so that we could take the animals to the veterinary and do all the things you need money for.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is the and enjoying what you're doing, even though it's so inconvenient sometimes and so difficult. Just sitting back and looking at the beauty around you, and not having to go in a subway somewhere. What? There's nothing wrong with going in a subway, but just that kind of a life is just so wonderful and so ennobling.
Thanks, Anne. Appreciate your story. You know, I want to finish with an email from Jesse in South Burlington, who writes, "I'll soon be medically retired from the military and will be returning to school full-time. I live in the new north end of Burlington and want to begin to live more self-sufficiently. I don't have much of a backyard, and sunlight is minimal during the summer due to the amount of trees, so how do I begin? My time is limited, as are my resources. I'd like to learn the skills now so that I might one day move back to the country and live off the grid as much as possible. Any advice would be appreciated."
It's a wonderful place called the Intervale.
I was going to say the same thing.
To go to the Intervale?
The Intervale, and they're, you know, it's not just a place. They're not just gardens. They're wonderful mentors, farmers, and others who can lead the way.
Mm-hmm. And what would you know, do you still point people to the good life who are interested in reading about that life, Rebecca, or are there other more recent books?
Well, there's a long bibliography in the back of my book, and I just think the Good Life books are classics and should be read, but they should be read with, you know, a grain of salt. And there are new books coming out all the time. I mean, Philip has a book coming out. I'll plug it. And there's some recent books on suburban homesteading that, again, I can't get you the title, but there's several books that have come out in the last 10 or 15 years that address homesteading in one way or another. So I think reading the gamut would be a great idea.
Anything to add to that list, Philip?
You know, there's a great book, Edible Forest Gardens, by Dave Jack. He does a really wonderful job laying out some of the plantings that you can do there. I've been actually surprised with a year of sabbatical. I didn't spend it all on YouTube, but as you type in homesteading, it's pretty interesting what you see out there. And the Dervais family, I believe they're in Pasadena, do an amazing job, and others as well, just trying to, you know, do this biointensive planting where they're planting as much as they can on a very small plot. And it's amazing what you can get out of that.
And your book, when will it come out? What's the focus?
It'll be out in June of this year, or this coming year. And the focus is really, you know, there's a bit of a narcissistic trend, I think, in the homesteading subgenre. I hope it's not that, but it's partly my story, but how my students have challenged me and the things I've learned about what homesteading needs to be in the 21st century.
Well, Philip Ackerman Leist, Associate Professor of Environmental Studies at Green Mountain College, and Rebecca Neal Gould, Associate Professor of Religion at Middlebury College and author of At Home in Nature, Modern Homesteading and Spiritual Practice in America. Thank you both very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you.